Welcome to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course with your hosts, Arielle Ford and Claire Zammit. Today's Soulmate Seminar is with Neil Donald Walsh on the topic, Overcoming Guilt and Regret, How to Open Your Heart to Love Again and Experience Lasting Bliss in Your Next Relationship. Neil Donald Walsh is a modern-day spiritual messenger whose words continue to touch the world in profound ways. His With God series of books has been translated into 27 languages, touching millions and inspiring important changes in their day-to-day lives. Neil Donald Walsh has published 12 other works, as well as a number of video and audio programs. Available throughout the world, each of the Conversations with God books has made the New York Times bestseller list. Conversations with God, Book 1, occupying that list for over 2.5 years.
So, Neil, we wanted to start sort of at the beginning, since we're speaking about love and relationships and manifesting soulmates. What is your understanding of what love is?
Oh, boy. It's taken a long time to get to anything even close to clarity on this, and I'm not sure that I'm at clarity, but my latest thought about it, after making many, many turns that were probably not for the highest or best, and certainly did not turn out as well as I would have liked, but my idea of love now is, it is, I think, a feeling that my life ultimately is not about me, but about the other, and for that matter, all others. It's a feeling that allows me to identify much more closely with, without getting poetic here, my true self and my larger purpose for being here, with the ultimate reality of all of life. It's the feeling that I've come to discover when I think about what I call God, the God of my understanding, and for that matter, just the same feeling that I have when I look at the awesome night sky. It doesn't always happen when I look at the night sky, but there are times. There are times when I've been known to be lying on my back porch looking at the night sky and virtually come to tears, just literally come to tears at the awesome beauty of it, or look at a sunset and virtually come to tears at the awesome beauty of it. Now, when you look at another person, another human being, and have that same feeling where you virtually come to tears. They do nothing. They're not saying anything. They're not giving you anything. They're not somehow presenting you with something. You're not really receiving any direct benefit in the common use of the word from them. They're just standing there, being there. And you look at them, and you nearly come to tears simply with your recognition of the beauty of what you're seeing. That's my definition of love.
Well, there's nothing to argue with there. Ah, that feels so good.
And I've had that feeling. I've had that feeling with my other, my wonderful other, many times. Even just last night, we were talking about something. She was conversing with me late yesterday afternoon, and I was simply looking at her, and just all of a sudden, nearly came to tears with the beauty—not just the physical beauty, but the soul beauty, the mind beauty, the heart beauty, and the physical beauty—the awesomeness of what I was in the presence of. And I often feel that way, and I don't know how to describe it, except that she can see that I'm almost coming to tears looking at her, and I don't know where to go with it after that, except to simply say, "I love you."
How would you define a soulmate?
Well, a soulmate is, first of all, I think at some larger level, I don't want to be predictable here, awfully predictable, but I think at some larger level we are all soulmates with each other. But in the understanding and within the context that people mostly use that phrase, I think a soulmate is literally that, a part of the same soul. Conversations with God told me that the soul is larger than we think it is, that it isn't a question of one soul per body, but that in fact a soul may be large enough and is large enough to encompass or envelop many more, many more than one body, many bodies in fact, and that across the span of time and space as well, incidentally, since time and space do not exist in my cosmology. So that, having said that, the soul that I call mine could also be the soul that you call yours, or could be the soul that Napoleon called his. That is, it is possible for the essence of that which is, which I happen to call my soul, to be inhabiting or enveloping or embracing or enclosing, if you will, a number of bodies, perhaps hundreds of bodies, at any given point in what we laughingly call time and space. So that a soulmate to me is a person who's being enveloped or embraced or encased, if you will, in the same soul essence that my body is encased in. They are literally, in the literal sense of the word, soul mates or soul partners. That is, they are inhabited by or created by or emerging from the same essential essence, the same essential soul. I have a thought, and conversations with God place this thought in my mind, that we all travel with the same, I'm going to just pick a number for the arbitrary convenience of it, with the same 1,000 people or the same 1,000 essences or physicalities from lifetime to lifetime, identifying themselves perhaps in different ways with different labels, but the same 1,000 parts of who we are. It's a thought that I hold, that we travel through lifetime after lifetime with this same collection of people, if you please, showing up in our lives as husbands, wives, brothers, lovers, friends, associates, and sometimes what we would call opposing people or enemies as well. And that we deal in the game of life with these same 1,000 people. And again, I'm using the number 1,000 as a convenience. It could be some finite number. Therefore, I think that soulmates are physicalizations, if you please, manifestations in physical form of people we have met before, we have interacted with before, we have danced with before. It's very much like the song from the musical comedy. It seems we've stood and talked like this before.
Well, certainly Claire and I are familiar with that feeling, and I love that your definition of soulmate is so inclusive and broad to take in so many people. You know, many of the people that we come across feel that they've failed repeatedly in love. They've had, you know, multiple divorces or relationships that didn't work out, and they're now contracting and afraid it'll never happen for them again. What do you have to share with these folks?
They have a right to feel that way. It's probably because they have done what they call fail at relationships. I have done what people call fail at relationships, and I've done so repeatedly as well. And I have probably a higher number of permanent relationships, that is, marriages, than most people would even dream of in a lifetime. I have learned, however, and I know this sounds terribly philosophical, and at times I listen to myself and I wonder, oh, man, you know, Neil, get off it. But in my more philosophical and, frankly, in my more clear moments, I'm aware that there's no such thing as failure, that not just in relationships, but in any aspect of life, for that matter, any artistic expression, any movement we make through life at all in any shape, way, manner, or form, failure simply does not exist. So for me, perhaps it's a defense mechanism, I don't know, but I've had to look at, and I've learned how to look at, my past so-called failures as really, it sounds so pedantic, it's almost embarrassed to say it, but stepping stones on the way to the largest expression of that experience in life that we call relationship. So I think that failure doesn't exist in my reality. I would then say to those people who have had that same experience that I've had, keep on, keep on, and always keep on, because in fact, your past so-called failures have simply thrown the door of understanding and of experience wide open for you. Someone said to a person who has been married multiple times, said to the wife of that person, why would you marry that person? He's been married like 4 or 5 days. He's like a four-time loser. And the observer said, no, he's a four-time learner. I would like to think that in my life I've learned something. My day-to-day interactions sometimes belie that. I sometimes act just as foolishly as I might have in my very first relationship. But I would like to imagine that those moments are much fewer these days than they were, in fact, when I was 25 or 35 or even 45. I'd like to think that I learned something along the way. And finally, I would say to people who are discouraged about getting into relationship because of their past so-called failures, there's no other richer or better way to live in any event. even if you think it's the next one is going to be just as difficult, just as challenging, and just as much of a so-called failure as the last ones. Get into it anyway, because in the end, when the whole dance is over, you will realize that having moved through life in personal, intimate relationship with another is probably the highest and most rapid form of evolution of which I am aware. That's not universally true for everybody. Some people do move forward rapidly by being totally alone, totally isolated, and by themselves, and not part of any intimate relationship. But I have not found a faster way to learn about myself and about life than in an intimate relationship with another. So if I can find someone, if I'm lucky enough to find someone who's willing to share that adventure with me, I consider myself lucky indeed, and I would do it again and again and even one more time still, if only for that potential that it offers me. The grandest mirror I have ever found into the inside of me is found in my beloved other.
That's beautifully said, Neil. And having had so many experiences of heartbreak on the path to love and relationships in my life, I experienced at different moments what I hear many people experience, which is a certain emotional overwhelm of loss and grief and despair and a feeling. It feels like sometimes in those moments that you will never find love again. Do you have any insight about how to actually release the emotional residue of a lot of those failures can leave us with our hope shattered?
Well, again, this is going to be a almost pedantic, predictable answer. Please forgive me for being so predictable, but I think we release the past residue by releasing our thought of who we are and what life is really all about. If we really buy into this illusion that we are our bodies, or for that matter, even that we are our minds, or even, if you please, that we are our souls, rather than who we really are, which is the essence of all three, and why we're really here on the earth, which has nothing to do with what most people are spending their time on this planet. If we can release those illusory thoughts, those illusory images, those illusory ideas about who we are and why we're here, and shift our innermost reality to a different identity and a different purpose, then I think the releasing of that residue becomes an almost automatic follow-up reaction. It's almost impossible not to release that residue. It's almost impossible not to let go of those lingering thoughts of disappointment and hurt and those fears of being hurt again, because we have a new idea of our identity, of who we are, where we are, and why we're here. That is why most spiritual masters or students who are at a high level in their march toward mastery, people like Paramahansa Yogananda and Thich Nhat Hanh and others, would not have really a normal answer to the question you just asked. How do you release the residue of past emotional failures or past emotional hurts or disappointments? Paramahansa would look at you in the eye and say, "What residue?" That wouldn't even know what you're talking about, because he doesn't identify with the dramas of everyday life, which can only be embraced by us. Those dramas can only be embraced as reality if we are totally unclear as to who we are and why we're here on this planet. If we imagine that the life we're living is real, we will really get caught up in, as I say to my lecture audiences, where's the guy, where's the girl, where's the guy, where's the car, get the guy, get the girl, get the car, get the house, get the kids, get the promotion, get the good job, get the office in the corner, get the grandkids, get the better house, get the better car, get the bigger office, finally get the gold watch for retirement, get the gray hair, get the sickness, and get the hell out. And that's how most people imagine their life to be, just a series of events from start to finish that have, in the end, they discover, nothing to do with who they really are. I'm writing a book right now called The Only Thing That Matters, and the first paragraph of the book goes like this. I observe that 98% of the world's people, myself included, spend 98% of their time on 98% of the stuff that doesn't matter at all and has nothing to do with why they're really here. And that, in one paragraph, is why the world is the way it is and why our lives are the way they are.
So, Neil, when you're in that 98%, which I find myself in probably 99% of the time, How do you shift out? What's your personal process to remind yourself to come back to the really meaningful stuff?
Well, I have three things I do. One, I write. I immediately get to a keyboard if I can, and I try to write my way out of it, which is a funny way to put it, but it's in fact what I do. I either get into writing my book, or I get into maybe posting a blog on the internet, or even for that matter responding to someone who's written to me asking for the kind of advice you're asking for now, and I write to them, and I write myself out of my state of mind, because I in particular find that when I get into my writing, I move to a place of mind which already knows what's so, and which is very clear about that. So it shifts my mind space from one place to another. The second thing I try to do is to realign my awareness, is to snap myself back into what's happening in the present moment, what Ram Dass would have called be here now. I'm not as successful at that as I am with the writing process, but I am sometimes successful at it. I can take a deep breath every once in a while and just allow myself to be here, right now, and to realize that none of the rest of it has any reality at all except what's going on right here, right now, where my true identity becomes apparent to me as well. And I like to read as well, because in addition to writing, I'll pick up a copy of Byron Katie's wonderful book, excuse me, her extraordinary book, Loving What Is. It's an older book. It's one of her first books, but it's still the classic book on this topic, or anything written by Eckhart Tolle, or anything written by Mary O'Malley. She's another extraordinary teacher who talks about our obsessions and how we obsess with things. And I would read anything by Mary O'Malley or by Byron Katie or by Eckhart Tolle. So read if you're in that space of mind. And you've got, even if you only have 15 minutes, you say, well, I don't have an hour and a half to sit down with a book. Everybody has 10 minutes. Always keep one of those books or a favorite book of yours nearby somewhere and run for it. Don't walk for it. Race for it. Pick it up, open to any page. You'll go to the right page, the perfect page every time, and read three or four pages and let yourself get recentered. And finally, if you have a partner, such as I do, who can help center you. And M is not always capable of doing this, but much of the time she is. If I'm out of center, I can go to her and say, I'm just out of center here. I'm buying the illusion again. And often M will look at me with the kindest face and the deepest compassion and talk me back into myself and give me back to myself in that way. Those are the three things that I do. I noticed that I didn't say any of the classic things, go meditate, you know, go do a yoga class or whatever. But these are the things that I do. But I'm rather unconventional, I'm sorry to say. So those are the ways that I try to get out of the illusion and back into my known reality.
Will you share with us your meeting with M and whether or not you were consciously working on bringing in a soulmate, or if it was divine intervention, or how you see it and how it happened?
Well, excuse me. I wouldn't say that I was consciously working on bringing in a soulmate. That would not be a fair description of what was going on in my life in that moment. In point of fact, I was in another relationship fairly happy in it. I wasn't, you know, deliriously over the top happy, but it was working most of the time, and I was okay, and I was fine with it. But I have to say that when M walked into the room, I knew instantly when I first saw M, the very first moment that we met, she came to my home with another person, a friend, a mutual friend of ours, someone that I knew that she knew, and she was that person's guest for the evening at an event that I was having at my house. And as soon as she walked in, I realized that I had encountered a soulmate. Instantly knew. I mean, it wasn't 15 seconds, and I knew. And I didn't do anything with that for 2.5 years. Never even said anything to her about it. Never said anything to anybody about it. It was just something I held close to my heart because I was in a relationship with, I might add, no intention of not being in that relationship. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't be in that relationship. So I thought that, but by the way, I'm glad I said that just now, because soulmates do not necessarily have to be romantic partners. they can be just the best friend in your life you ever, ever, ever had. So just because I recognized her as someone from a deep past, what I call my deep past, going past many, many lifetimes, just because I recognized her as my soulmate did not necessarily mean that I was instantly thinking, how can I get out of my present relationship? There's the one. That's not the experience I had at all. The experience I did have, however, is I've known this person for a very, very long time. And then the question came up, what, if anything, do I intend to do about that? So I wrestled with that question for 2.5 years. But even during that 2.5 year period of time, it never occurred to me that somehow Em and I would be life partners, because I was in a relationship. But I did look at, how can I deal with the interactions that I'm going to be having now, or do I want to create interactions between me and this other person in a way that's appropriate to who I am and defines and declares myself to me? And that was not an easy question to answer, because sometimes it did involve certain interior struggles and longings that I had to deal with and look at. And I think I'm describing the experience of many, many people now on the planet. As it happened in my life, this is just what happened in my experience. My relationship with the person that I was then in relationship with, in fact, dissolved and ended around 2.5 years later for reasons entirely disassociated that had nothing to do with my friendship with Em, which was just such a social friendship. We never even had a private conversation in 2.5 years. We did see each other during that 2.5 year period of time, always in the presence of others, always at social events and social gatherings, and we never even had a private exchange between us. That's what the interesting part about our relationship. But my relationship with the other person with whom I was cohabitating did end after the end of 2.5 years, and suddenly I was in a different situation, a different life circumstance. And at that point, I allowed myself to move into a closer interaction with Em. She was out of relationship at that time, and we found, amazingly, because neither one of us had said anything about this for 2.5 years, that we both felt the same way. She, in fact, I'll let her talk for herself if she has a willingness to, but she, in fact, had some of those same thoughts about me. Likewise, stayed within, kept on coloring inside the lines, staying within the bounds of what was totally appropriate to her space in life and to mine. But when we both discovered that we were both free, then the storm gates, blew off, the barn doors blew open, and we allowed ourselves to move quickly into a close, intimate, romantic, and wonderful partnership and relationship with each other.
Mm. That's beautiful. So romantic. So you now consider Em your soulmate?
Why, without any doubt, she is my other. Mm-hmm. We have called each other our other. From the very first moment that we had a private conversation. Mm. She is my other, and we wear rings on our finger, on our left finger, a third finger, left hand, that say that. The word other is, the ring is actually carved into the word other on each of our wedding rings.
And how would you describe, Neil, the experience of this kind of soulmate relationship compared to other relationships?
It's the most challenging and the most absorbing and the most rewarding at the same time experience I've ever had. It's challenging in that Em really is my other. She has not, and because she's my other, she holds not only all of the aspects of me that are joyous and wonderful, intense creativity, almost at a genius level, frankly, incredible sensitivity, deep, deep awareness, endless compassion, and all the other aspects, and wisdom, frankly, all the aspects of me that I find in myself and that others have described in me. But she also, I think, would acknowledge, has many of the same aspects of me that people have found perhaps not quite so attractive. And so I see myself across the room in the pluses and the so-called minuses, or the totality, if you please, of who I am. And that can make it very, very challenging. I have never, ever, ever been with anyone who presented myself to myself from A to Z, from 1 to 10, up and down, left and right, the way M does. When I look across the room, I simply see myself in another body. And the result of that is I know or imagine myself to know her motivation behind everything, the wonderful things she does and some of the things that she does that don't show up as all that wonderful. And that helps me understand deeply because, for instance, she might say something to me that isn't the nicest thing to say in a particular moment. And I'll think, you know what? I know exactly the state of mind that that statement came from. I know exactly what's going on over there. Then the only question will be, am I going to act on that and have as much compassion with her as I have with myself or not? Well, since I tend to be terribly self-critical and don't allow myself a lot of room to show up as less than totally perfect, I find myself not always allowing the next person any more room than I allow myself. Not a good idea. Not a good idea. So what I'm learning with M is as I learn to give M a little more space to be imperfect from time to time, I give myself more space as well. In that sense, the relationship turns into a wonderfully self-healing experience. Therefore, if I had to describe the relationship, how would I describe it as different from other relationships? It's far more self-healing, self-revealing, and self-creative than any other relationship I've ever been in. And I think that if you're in your relationship with your true soulmate, you'll discover that it is those three things: self-revealing, self-healing, and self-creating.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, it's wonderful to hear you share about those different struggles with yourself and with M as well, because I know a lot of people feel like that somehow they need to be perfect to be worthy of a soulmate relationship.
Well, if that's the case, I'm not wrong.
And the reason that they don't have one is because they're flawed somehow. What would you share about that?
The reason they don't have one is because they're what?
They're flawed, that they have flaws. A lot of people think that the reason that they don't have a soulmate relationship is because they have, you know, there's something wrong with them.
Actually, it's the other way around. What I would say to people is the reason that you are eligible for a soulmate relationship is because you have flaws, and the purpose of the soulmate relationship is to heal and eliminate what you call your flaws. It's for one thing, first, is to let you know that your flaws really aren't flaws. They're not like fault lines on the surface of your being. That's not, in fact, what they are. They're simply parts of you that you can either accept or change at will as you move through the process of recreating yourself anew in the next grandest version of the greatest vision ever you held about who you are. That is, the point I'm making is this: God sees us as perfect just the way we are now, even as we would look at, let's say, a two-week-old or a two-month-old or a two-year-old child. I mean, we just don't look at a two-year-old child and start picking out his faults or talking to her in terms of what she's not doing right. I mean, because we're very, very clear that that child is innocent of any preconceived notion of what perfection is in any event. And in their purity and innocence, they are perfect, even as they knock over the ink bottle and ruin your best dress. It doesn't even occur to us to make them wrong about that. Yet, we make ourselves wrong about those kinds of things in life. If we saw ourselves as God sees us, we would smile a lot. We would know that we're perfect just as we are standing here. Now, the purpose of soulmate relationships is to give us the golden opportunity that only evolutionary relationships could possibly provide, the opportunity to redefine and recreate ourselves. In fact, to recreate our definition of perfection, to say, if you think this is good, wait till you see me tomorrow. Wait till you see me in the next moment. Watch this, because I get better and better and better. By my own definition of what better is, I evolve and become a grander version of divinity itself through my relationship with this other person. That's what I'm experiencing with M. And that's the purpose of the relationship. It's not to give me what I think I need or supply me what I think I don't have enough of. Those are such ancient and trivial and primary elementary school definitions of relationship. But the definition of my relationship with M is to provide me with a golden, blessed, sacred opportunity each moment to make a new decision about who I am and who I choose to be. and then to reflect that decision in my every action, thought, word, and deed, and then to share my decision and choice with my beloved other with gratitude and thanks, and to be able to say to that person, in truth, in so many ways, you have made me what I am today.
Mm. That is so beautiful. Neil, for those that are on the line that have recently left relationships and they're divorced or broken up and they're experiencing guilt or feelings of responsibility for the pain of the one that they left, what would you say to that?
I felt it. First, I would say I have felt it. And in some muted way, in some way in the background way, I still feel it. There are still relationships that I've had in the past about which I feel bad, about which I feel a pang of guilt that I didn't do that right, that I hurt them, that I should have known better, should have acted in a better way. It's perfectly normal and perfectly natural. That's the first thing I would say. So don't make yourself wrong for feeling that guilt. However, having said that, because by the way, I don't know anybody, including M, or anybody else I've ever met in my life who hasn't had those feelings. It's so normal and so natural that probably everybody you would talk to on the street has had those feelings. And you know what? We should have those feelings at some level. I want to use the word should advisedly, but it's appropriate for us to have those feelings if we are evolving human beings, because those feelings tell us about our own humanity. We would be inhumane not to have those feelings. If we felt that we hurt someone and felt that we didn't do it quite right and that we could have done that a lot better and that someone suffered because of us, it would be abnormal for us not to feel bad about that. Who wouldn't feel bad about that? Now, having said that, to dwell on it, to focus on it, to let it run our experience, to not forgive ourselves for it, is another matter altogether. And what I'm learning and have learned in my life is to be able to feel that guilt and then transform it into regret. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I worked on her staff, and she taught me a wonderful thing in my life. She taught me the difference between guilt and regret. She said, guilt is eternal. You can't ever be unguilty if you think you're guilty. That is, it's a label you slap on yourself, and you're guilty of that crime forever and ever. Regret, however, is another matter altogether. So the idea is to transform your guilt into regret, to say, you know, I regret I did that. I regret that it happened that way. I regret that I didn't know as much as I know now, so old, so soon, so smart, so late. I regret that I didn't know then what I know now. But I'm not guilty, because guilt indicates malice aforethought, intention to deliberately damage or hurt another. And there are very few times in my life, I mean, very few, I can't think of one, truthfully, where that was true about me. And that's true for most people as well. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross taught me, look, guilt is not appropriate. Regret is what you want to look at. But hold on to your regrets, because your regrets help you to not make those same mistakes again in the future. So I would say to a person who is suffering from deep guilt, drop the guilt, embrace regret, move forward, and then say to all the angels in heaven and all the gods of all the universes and to the spirit of that other person, I deeply regret what I did with you. And in fact, what I did to you, I deeply regret it. And my promise from my soul to yours is that I will never do it again.
Mm. That is so beautiful. What do you have to say about honesty in relationships? Should we just let it rip? This is exactly, I'm being honest with you. I think you look absolutely terrible in that outfit, or you're rude to the waitress, or whatever, or is there a kinder, gentler approach to honesty?
Well, the way you phrase the question answers itself. You want me to give you an honest answer, or should I give you
I want the Neil answer.
I had the great gift of crossing paths in my life with a master. He was called Futsu. The word Futsu is a Chinese word meaning master. His name was Futsu Trion, Francis Trion. He was a master of a Chinese martial art. And he said to me once, and I never forgot it, he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, Neil, you are a very authentic, truthful person. May I share something with you? Speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace. And I've tried very hard to do that. I don't do it always. Sometimes my truth just bubbles up and bursts out. and it just, you know, comes out of me. But I try very hard to follow his injunction. Speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace. And I've come to conclude in life that there is a way for us to say what is completely authentic and absolutely truthful. That is, what is our truth. But say it in a way that does not necessarily have to be hurtful, damaging, or abrasive to others. In the book Friendship with God, I was given to note that there are five levels of truth-telling, each of which are very difficult for the average person, myself included, to embrace. Level one, tell the truth to yourself about yourself. Level two, tell the truth to yourself about another. Level three, tell the truth to another about yourself. Level four, tell the truth about that other to that other. And level five, tell the truth to everyone about everything. Finally, I would say this about truth. I was told in conversations with God, and I'm very clear about it, there's no such thing as absolute truth. Truth itself is subjective. My truth is not your truth, and your truth may not be mine. And so we have to be very, very clear that truth is a very subjective experience. That is, it is what is true for you. And even in my life, and all of us have learned this, of course, even my own truths change from year to year, period to period in my life, and sometimes from minute to minute. I might say at 4 o'clock, you know what's true for me? I want to go out to dinner and a movie tonight. And at 6 o'clock, when everyone's all ready to go, I say, actually, I don't want to do that anymore. And, you know, a person can say to me, well, you just said at 4 o'clock. I mean, I've been planning all day for it. I say, I know, but that was then, and this is now. So what I've learned about truth is that truth is what Hemingway would have called a movable feast. And I needs must have compassion with myself and with another when truths change, because they do, and I want to use this word clearly, because truths do change inevitably.
Wow.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course. For more information about how you can download the audios in this series or order the CD set and companion workbook, please visit soulmateaudios.com. Again, that's soulmateaudios.com. On behalf of Ariel Ford, Claire Zammit, and our event partners, we want to thank you again for participating in this series and send you much love and support on your journey to manifesting your soulmate.